Last Wednesday, four inmates escaped from a county jail in north central Kansas, where they were being held because the state system was too overcrowded. According to a Kansas Sentencing Commission report from earlier this year, men's prisons are 266 inmates over capacity and growing. Here in KC, our city's Civil Rights Division is bringing new attention to the issues of mass incarceration and looking at the escalating number of citizens in prison and the challenges they face upon reentry when it comes to employment and housing. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll also look at other modern-day civil rights issues facing the most vulnerable among us, including fair housing, voter suppression, and predatory payday lending. That's all ahead on Central Standard, but first, the news. Good morning, Kansas City. America has the highest rate of prisoners per capita of any industrialized nation. For many, this makes the issue of mass incarceration one of the most pervasive civil rights concerns today. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining me now is Ayanna Hightower-Mannon and Paul Pierce of Kansas City's Civil Rights Division of the Human Relations Department. They are both civil rights investigators. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Now, tell us about your jobs as civil rights investigators. What does that entail?
Well, what we do is we investigate complaints of employment discrimination, public accommodations, as well as housing.
And what complaints typically come in?
Well, most of our complaints are, the majority are race complaints, individuals that feel like they've been discriminated against based on race, or in that similarly situated white individuals or non-blacks have been treated more favorably than they have in similar situations.
Is there a baseline for how you prove cases such as that?
Well, what we do is we take witness statements, interview the person who's filed the complaint, the housing provider in housing cases, or the employer in employment cases. We also take statements from other witnesses if there are any. We gather relevant documents. For example, if someone feels they've been denied a promotion, we would look at the job description, the qualifications of the individual selected, the qualifications of that of the person who was not, and try to, between ourselves as investigators, our supervisor, and the city's law department, look at the evidence that's been presented and make a recommendation as to whether or not there's enough evidence to show that person was discriminated against.
So you're essentially matching the circumstances against the statutes.
Right.
To come up with a
exactly.
conclusion and a recommendation.
Exactly.
You've identified the biggest civil rights issue in modern times, or at least up to now, as mass incarceration. How did that come about?
Well, if you, I don't know if your listeners remember the war on drugs that started in the mid to late 80s into the early 90s. At that time, there were about 300,000 or so individuals that were incarcerated in the United States. Since then and up until now, there's in excess of 2 million. That number grew in large part because of the mandatory sentences for possession of crack cocaine and the disproportionately long-term sentences that were handed down compared to comparable possession charges and sentences for powder cocaine, which as a result had a disproportionate impact on the number of blacks and Hispanics that were had come in contact with the penal system for extended periods of time.
And that certainly has lasting effects. How does civil rights then come into play, or civil rights violations then come into play as a result of this mass incarceration?
Well, what we've found that's happened is that when individuals come out of the system, quite honestly, to avoid going back, you've got to have a decent place to live and you've got to have a job. And they, housing providers and employers many times have these blanket policies that prohibit hiring of felons, renting to individuals with criminal histories. And what happens is, again, because these blanket policies, which on their face are neutral, have what's called a disparate impact on blacks and Hispanics in that they are being denied these housing opportunities, these employment opportunities, simply because of their criminal history.
Are the complaints similar when they come in based on ex-felons complaints? Are they across the board pretty similar?
They're pretty similar. You know, once a lot in employment especially, an individual will go through the interview process, even if there's the criminal history question on an application, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Most times that will eliminate you, period. And again, it's without consideration of the nature of the felony, how long ago it was, whether there was imprisonment, paid a fine, probation, parole, what have you. If there's no reasonable relationship between the opportunity that you're seeking and the felony that you were convicted of, there's no consideration of that, whether or not the person is qualified or not.
How do you then determine discrimination if there's no legal protection for felons?
Well, what the city has done and the Civil Rights Division has done is we've taken the stand that employers or housing providers who have policies or practices which exclude ex-offenders because of their status as an ex-offender and it has a disparate impact on blacks and Hispanics, what we've done is we've taken the disparate impact theory approach to investigate these complaints. And so that's enabling us to look at ex-offender status not as a protected category, but how it disparately impacts African-Americans and Hispanics in comparison to any other race. So that's the way we're able to actually investigate those complaints.
We'll get into the deeper aspects of disparate impact and the intended and unintended consequences that it has in our society. But along those lines, why is this an issue that we all should be concerned about, whether we're black or Latino, whether we're ex-offenders or whether we have clean rap sheets? Why is this something that affects everybody?
Well, I think it's an issue of public safety. The individuals, if you think about it, who rarely come in contact or don't come in contact as often with the criminal justice system are those with suitable housing and good jobs. And from that standpoint, if you want people to not have to reoffend or to not offend in the first place, you got to have a job. You got to have a decent place to live. And from that standpoint, it keeps people public safety, to answer your question, is an issue that crosses every boundary. Every part of town, every city, every state wants to be safe.
Is there also a sense that we need to create an environment that disincentivizes going back to jail or repeat offenses?
Exactly. I mean, people who go, and if you've read some of these articles, I think one about the Murder Factory article from a few years ago, the individuals that were interviewed almost said universally, one of the things that would have kept them from going to prison in the first place was having a good job. And this is from the people themselves, not just some study, not just some anecdotal evidence, but this is directly from those who are living inside the prison system, you know, on a daily basis.
Our guests are Paul Pierce and Ayanna Hightower-Mannon from the Civil Rights Division of Kansas City's Human Relations Department. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and this is Central Standard. Now, Ayanna, reentry into society is a huge issue for convicted felons. Is that part of what makes mass imprisonment a major civil rights issue?
Oh, definitely. When we look at the mass number of incarcerated persons coming out each year, there's always going to be an issue where it comes to housing and employment, those barriers that they're going to face. What we're looking at as far as the Civil Rights Division is that discrimination is everly present when it comes to ex-offenders. And so they're already penalized. They've served their time when they went to jail. When they come out, we don't want that discrimination to supersede what they're trying to do as far as positive reentry experiences. So what we're looking at is that if we can try to lessen the examples and experiences that they're having as far as getting adequate housing, getting relevant employment so that they can get on their feet, we have a job to do. And we want to bring some relevancy to the issues that they're facing every day when it comes to experiences in housing and employment.
Paul Pierce, what are some of the most common cases of unfair treatment that ex-offenders receive?
Well, when it comes to housing, one of the things that we found is that housing providers will have these blanket policies that prohibit them, they say, from renting to ex-offenders. They try to say for they try to use the business necessity excuse or some type of business necessity rationale, basically saying that we don't want to be liable for the acts of an ex-offender in case they harm a resident, damage property, what have you. But our research has found that once an ex-offender has been out of prison, off probation, off parole for between 7 and 10 years without having reoffended, they're no more likely to commit an offense than someone who's never committed one. And so that reasoning, that type of rationale, you know, negates that, well, if we rent a bunch of ex-offenders, they'll be out here tearing things up. They'll hurt our other residents, and we don't want to be liable for that. In employment, it's about the same, that the assumption is that just because someone has a felony in their history, that they're prone to immediate frustration on the job, and therefore they'll act out violently when they get frustrated. And that notion of uncontrolled anger, rage, what have you, negates any other qualification they may have. And so we'll just cut you off at the once we know you're an ex-offender, and we won't consider your qualifications, your rehabilitation, or what other tools you might bring to the table.
Are there types of employment that ex-offenders are steered to prevent these types of discriminatory practices?
Well,
that are more palatable for ex-offenders than others?
Well, we've found that there are a lot of employers who will hire ex-offenders, for example, in the construction industry, you know, janitorial services, landscaping, things like that. That's not to say that once someone commits a felony or a misdemeanor, that's all they can do, but that those industries, you know, service industries, washing cars, things like that, seem to be where a lot of ex-offenders go because the need for a lot of jobs now require some type of technology, you know, knowledge, computer training, you know, things that you would, you know, acquire in college or beyond college. And if you spend your time in the penitentiary or in and out of the penitentiary, you don't have a chance to acquire those skills, and that forces you into certain types of employment.
And not only do they are not able to acquire those skills, but what happens is once you are labeled an ex-offender or have committed a felony, you are no longer able or qualified for financial aid. So you can't even get federal funding to put yourself in college. So you have to think of an alternative way to be successful.
And what are some of those alternative ways, once these investigations are complete, that you are getting out there in the community to try to get the word out?
Well, one of the things that we've tried to talk with housing providers about and employers is to eliminate these blanket prohibitions on the hiring of ex-offenders. Not that that cannot be a consideration, because, you know, just about everywhere you go, there's a background check done, even a credit check done before someone is hired onto a job. And we're not suggesting that practice end. What we do suggest is that the criminal history issue be addressed once someone is found that they've otherwise been qualified, they otherwise have the ability to do the job, and at the pre-offer stage, or at least the offer stage, you can do your background check, and if something comes up, you can at least speak to that applicant about, hey, we found this in your background check, do you want to tell us about it? And, you know, a lot of agencies that work with ex-offenders, they drill them on, you know, in interview settings, how they talk about their criminal history, but they never get to use that skill because at the application stage, most times they're excluded from consideration.
Is this something that you're putting out there in discussion to create a sort of further step in allowing a dialogue between potential employers and ex-offenders that may clear up those perceptions?
Yes, definitely. I think that during our summit, that the panel discussion that we're going to have, which will feature an employer that hires ex-offenders and a housing provider that provides housing to an ex-offender, as well as having an ex-offender to kind of talk about their experiences. Dialogue is always great, so we can get some understanding as far as both sides of what's going on. But I think that having that dialogue will allow us to get the perspective of the ex-offenders as far as what they're experiencing, and then the housing provider and the employment side to see what are those barriers that we're trying to overcome.
Ayanna Hightower-Mannon and Paul Pierce are our guests. They are both from Kansas City's Human Relations Department, where they are civil rights investigators. The fourth annual Civil Rights Summit takes place on April 27th at 9 a.m. at the Southeast Community Center at 4201 East 63rd Street in Kansas City, Missouri. The event is held annually in April in commemoration of Fair Housing Month. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. As you may have read on our website at kcur.org or in the Kansas City Star or heard around the street, our dear friend Walt Bodine is heading into full retirement. We'll be celebrating him this week with three special shows. Tomorrow and Thursday at our regular time slot at 10 a.m., KCUR will be digging into some of the archive recordings and a special Walt Bodine documentary. Then on Friday, the Walt Bodine Show co-hosts will be in the studio for Walt's very last show, his final show. That's Friday, April 27th at 10 a.m. We hope you can tune in to celebrate Walt's contributions to Kansas City and the community at large as he enters full retirement. Thank you, Walt Bodine. Meanwhile, here on Central Standard, our guests are Ayanna Hightower-Mannon and Paul Pierce from the Civil Rights Division of Kansas City's Human Relations Department, who say mass incarceration is one of the biggest civil rights issues of the day, especially when it comes to disparities in housing and unemployment. Tell us again and remind our listeners as we delve deeper into this issue of disparate impact theory and how it creates a problem for those who were in prison and want to get back on track. Disparate impact theory. Paul Pierce?
Well, what we do is on a disparate impact case is there's a facially neutral policy that an employer or housing provider will apply to any applicant. And while that policy is neutral on its face, and when you put that policy into practice, it has a disparate impact, and there's a statistical analysis that you can do that will show that that facially neutral policy has a negative disparate impact on blacks and Hispanics when it comes to being denied housing opportunities or employment opportunities. In this case, because of criminal history.
The specific language says unjustified adverse impact on members of a protected class.
When you look at the conviction and incarceration rates of African Americans and Hispanics, you will find that they are disproportionately incarcerated and convicted at a higher rate than any other race in the country, as well as if you look at their representation in the population compared to their incarceration rates is at a disparate impact. And so, as we look at this theory, we're looking at the policies and the practices of employers and housing providers in comparison to the ex-offender status and the numbers of ex-offenders coming out every year, and saying that these policies and practices have a disparate impact on particularly African Americans and Hispanics because of their high rates of incarceration.
Are there examples that we hear about sometimes in these discriminatory practices that may include written tests, heightened rate requirements, additional educational requirements, or subjective procedures such as drug testing or other interviews that don't happen to other people?
Well, a lot of times what we found is that the minimum qualifications for a particular position apply across the board, or a particular housing opportunity apply across the board. The problem that we found is when there's a ban that restricts someone from a particular opportunity only because of their criminal history, which, of course, is going to either be brought to light on an application where it asks, have you ever been convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor, or during the course of a criminal background check. And once that application question puts an ex-offender in a tough spot, because on the one hand, if you answer honestly, you're going to disqualify yourself because of that ban that's in place, whether you know about the ban or not. If you answer dishonestly, and you get the job or you get the housing opportunity, and it's determined later that you have this criminal history, well, now you lose it. You lose it because you falsified your application. And there's no way, there's no legitimate business reason around that, that particular situation for the person who needs that housing opportunity or needs that job to stay out of prison.
So it's a catch-22, yes. Six on one hand, half a dozen on the other,
yes.
Any way you slice it. Is there an educational component to all of this to get the word out to about how ex-felons can adjust to society as well as how society can adjust to ex-felons coming out? What's being done on both sides?
I think part of what we do as a Civil Rights Division is we have this educational outreach component that we're responsible for. And part of that is actually having this summit so we can have the opportunity to have some discussion, some education, some outreach, some resources for ex-offenders as well as housing providers and employers to educate them on the barriers that ex-offenders are facing as well as what they can do, the rights the ex-offenders can possibly have and what housing providers and employers can do to help the reentry process for these people.
And we'll talk more about that summit when we return. The summit in question that Ayanna is talking about is the 4th Annual Civil Rights Summit, which takes place on April 27th at the Southeast Community Center, 4201 East 63rd Street in Kansas City. The event is held annually in April to commemorate the Fair Housing Month in April. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard on 89.3 FM. When we return, our guests will tell us more about this upcoming community summit, dealing with some of the issues we've been discussing here, and more. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guests are Paul Pierce and Ayanna Hightower-Mannon from the Civil Rights Division of Kansas City's Human Relations Department, who both say mass incarceration is one of the biggest civil rights issues of the day. We've been talking about the challenges ex-cons face with the discrimination after they're being freed from prison and some of the challenges youth offenders face to keep from going back to jail. And there's a summit coming up. Ayanna, your group has a summit touching on these issues. Tell us about that summit.
We have a summit Friday, April the 27th at Southeast Community Center from 9 to 2:30 p.m. We're going to have in the morning portion, there will be a guest speaker, Nicole Porter from the Sentencing Project. We also have an ex-offender panel where we're going to discuss barriers that ex-offenders face as far as housing and employment. We're also going to have a luncheon, free luncheon, open and free to the public. Gregory King, who is the acting director for HUD, will also be there as our luncheon speaker. In the afternoon segment, we have three workshops, one focusing on voter suppression, which will feature Diana Cashin with the Brennan Center for Justice. The second workshop will be a predatory payday lending workshop, which CCO Communities Creating Opportunities will host that workshop. And then we have a third one, which is a fair housing update, which will be hosted by HUD.
Now, speaking of which, there's some ancillary issues here. Let's talk about them briefly. What has your group learned about voter suppression in our area, Paul Pierce?
Well, since the election of President Obama in 2008 and going even back to Bush versus Gore in 2000, we saw what happens when a lot of people actually show up and vote. Since 2008, a lot of state houses have become Republican controlled. And since that time, many of those states have decided, Missouri included, to pass laws or to try to pass laws that require state-issued IDs for the purpose of voting. If you know anything about getting a state ID, you have to have your birth certificate. There's a charge that's involved. And what we're going to be focusing on is the not just the process of getting that state ID in the first place and the cost involved, but the everyday effects of the disenfranchisement of probably, in this case, up to 5 million or so voters who don't have state IDs, the elderly, young people in college. You can't use your college ID if you show up to vote, at least right now you can't. Many people who have been using utility bills for years all of a sudden won't be able to do that. And that really, it just has your address and, you know, name and address on it and something that identifies you as you. And so there's going to be a lot of discussion about what the impact of the passage, if any, of these voter IDs will be when it comes to not just the 2012 election, but beyond that.
And that's also yet another issue that's related to the imposition on felons as
right.
well.
Because typically when someone's convicted of a felony, they lose their right to vote. In some states, that vote is being restored. That right to vote is being restored. So that issue of who can and who cannot vote and why could definitely have an effect on the outcome of not just 2012, but elections in the future.
You have the Housing and Urban Development Department coming in to speak as well. What are some of the biggest fair housing issues in our area?
Well, HUD is going to have a breakout session on updating us on fair housing laws. We've noticed a lot of complaints being filed based on disability, design and construction of units built after 1991 that have to be built a certain way so that they're accessible for individuals with disabilities. There'll be some updates on that. Certainly some updates related to our topic of mass incarceration and its effect on the application of Title VIII, the Fair Housing Act, and a lot of the other age-related cases. You've seen and heard about these large class action discrimination suits that start off as complaints just like the ones that we investigate every day.
What do you hope people will get out of this summit, and how will this help you do your jobs better, Ayanna?
I hope that people will get an open eye to the barriers that ex-offenders face, maybe get an opportunity to even speak to one, to get personal and understand that it's not an individual thing but a community thing and something that we all need to work towards to overcome and provide opportunities for all ex-offenders, as well as I hope that we get some folks registered to vote for this upcoming election.
And your thoughts on what the community will get out of the summit, Paul?
Well, like Ayanna said, we're using this opportunity to educate the public, and when we know better, we do better, and that was our focus. That from the very first time we did this 4 years ago, until whenever it is we do the last one of these, it will always be the goal to give information, good information to the public that needs it desperately.
We've been talking about the 4th Annual Civil Rights Summit, which will take place here on April 27th at 9 a.m. to 2:30?
Yes, sir.
2:30 p.m. at the Southeast Community Center, 4201 East 63rd Street here in Kansas City. The event is held annually in April to commemorate Fair Housing Month. Our guests have been Ayanna Hightower, Manon, and Paul Pierce from the Civil Rights Division of Kansas City's Human Relations Department. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And the event is free and open to the public.
All right. As you may have read on our website at kcur.org or in the Kansas City Star, our dear friend Walt Bodine is heading into full retirement. We'll be celebrating this week with 3 special shows tomorrow and Thursday at 10 a.m. We'll be digging into some archived recordings and special Walt Bodine documentaries on Friday, April 27th at 10 a.m. Tune in to celebrate Walt's contributions to KC as he enters full retirement. And I'd like to take this opportunity personally to say thank you for Walt Bodine for paving the way for us and this program here on Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard.